welcome to Occam's Razor, Episode 8. I'm your host, Jim Burchill. I'm here every week. Once again, Mark Capel, paranormal investigator, is in the studio, and a very special guest all the way from Sydney, Australia. We've got him on the line. Is Roger Stankovic, who is the Australasian president of MUFON.
All right, well, things are heating up in the UFO community quite a bit at the moment with the revelations put forward by Bob Lazar in his new documentary, but a new documentary on Netflix featuring Bob. Bob first came out with this information sort of in the early 80s or mid to late 80s, actually. And it was relatively sort of poo-pooed at the time by skeptics and those within the UFO community. This info has been given kind of a rehash by this documentary. Bob still looks like he's not a willing participant in it, but he has been making a few appearances on podcasts such as Joe Rogan and things like that. First of all, Roger, I was going to ask, how has the latest information been received by those in the UFO community? Is this something you already knew about, or is there something new that's come out that you didn't know about before? And how's it all being treated, with a degree of skepticism or, accepted as fact?
Well, initially, I personally can only speak for myself, really, because I do talk to other people about Bob Lazar, but I'm not sure how the UFO. I think the UFO community in general does support him. There was an instance where several years ago, deceased Stanton Friedman he actually did some background checks with Bob to find out whether he actually worked at MIT and Caltech, as he stated, and he couldn't find any information about him. So I'm not sure what year that happened. I mean, it would have been shortly after Bob had come out as working at S4, and about a year or two. And then once I heard Stanton Friedman state this, I actually thought that Bob was a charlatan. So basically, I didn't follow him after a while. And then I used to listen to his YouTube videos and about S4 and everything, and read up on him only recently when Jeremy Corbell had rehashed the whole story that I actually firmly believe now that this guy's absolutely telling the truth. And there's a lot of information that Jeremy's come up with that actually sort of solidifies in my mind that Bob is actually legitimate.
What do you think are the strong points to Lazar's story that changed your view?
Okay, so the strong points are that certain things fit into to what I know about UFOs, in the sense that there's one thing that Bob mentions about the craft that he was actually working on. And it was coincidental that I found out that, I'm sure that everyone's heard of the antimatter reactor that he's stated that he's actually seen in the craft, and it's basketball shaped, and it's actually on a metal platform, and then it has what's called a wave guide that the centerpiece of that reactor goes right up through the spacecraft, right up to the top, and it has a wave guide. What's called a wave guide. It's a little, like a little antenna on top of the actual spacecraft. Well, that really rang a bell with me, because when you look at the different UFOs that have come through, the pictures of them and whatever, some of them have this little antenna on top of them. And I always thought, gee, that looks really fake, but it's actually not, because if it's part of the anti-gravity reactor, well, then it all makes sense. And if you look back into one of the most significant photographs ever taken of a UFO, which was at McMinnville in 1950, that UFO has got that little waveguide on it. And that I found absolutely astonishing, that the most credible photograph ever taken of a UFO that's never been disputed ever since 1950 has a waveguide on top of it, of the craft. And apart from that, there's other things that he mentions, all about element 115 and how there must be an island of stability in this element, that and how it can be used in the anti-gravity reactor to actually produce.
Sorry, Roger. For dummies like me, could you explain a bit more about element 115? And I know it's to do with the propulsion of the reactor, isn't it?
Yep. Yep. So I'm not an expert either, but basically element 115 or unknown pentium was discovered, I think, in 2003. It's basically just a heavy metal, heavy element. I beg your pardon. It was never in the periodic table when I was at university. So there was a whole bunch of, blank spaces, in the periodic table when I was at university, which is many years ago. But, ever since then, scientists have been creating much more heavy metals than heavy elements than there were before, basically by smashing atoms in linear accelerators. And basically, if they exist for a certain period of time, enough to actually say yes, that they've existed for, like, that there's been four atoms that have been created in a linear accelerator that lasted, you know, several hundred milliseconds. Well, then they can classify that as an element that actually it was together. The protons were together for an instance where you could it became sort of like stable for a couple of seconds or milliseconds. So this 115 was created in Germany. In their linear accelerator by smashing calcium ions onto americium, which was electroplated onto a titanium plate. And so what they do, they smash calcium electrons, which have got 20 protons in them, into americium, which has got 90 protons, and that once the two elements combine, they form element 115, which is this muscovium, which is what they use in space, apparently using in this as an anti-gravity in the anti-gravity reactor. So basically 115 can't be it can be created in linear accelerators on Earth, but it's not found naturally on Earth.
The question is where do we get that from?
Okay, so basically Bob Lazar's saying that it could occur naturally on the planet that these alleged extraterrestrials originate from. So we can manufacture four atoms for a couple of hundred milliseconds. That's it, because it's unstable. But there might be, Jeremy Corbell himself in that interview with Joe Rogan's was saying that there might be an island of stability, which means that there might be an atomic mass of 115 that's stable. He's rung up several nuclear physicists who were saying that yes, it's possible to find an island of stability, which means that it doesn't decay. So normally, anything between the first atom on the periodic table, which is hydrogen, to atomic number 20, there's one proton for every neutron in the atomic nucleus. But anything beyond there, the actual atomic nucleus becomes more difficult. The protons within the nucleus have to stay together by the strong nuclear forces. So basically we tend to, elements tend to have more neutrons in the center of the nucleus as we progress down the periodic table. And so basically they're saying that the upshot is basically there is that there must be, or theoretically there must be an isotope of 115. Element 115 that's stable, and that it can only be found in certain planets in the universe, and those planets that have this 115 must only have it because of an extreme explosion like two neutron stars. So stars can actually collapse and form black holes, as you know, or neutron stars, Some of those binary systems are two star systems like Zeta Reticuli, which Bob Lazar mentions. Eventually, once those stars collapse, they form neutron stars, and these binary systems are revolving around each other. But eventually, the gravitational forces between them will cause them to smash together, and the forces are enormous, huge atomic forces that once these neutron stars collapse into each other, the forces can create really heavy elements like 115, and that once this explosion happens, all these heavy elements get dispersed into the interstellar space, and they form eventually dust in clouds in space. And basically, when they actually form planets through accretion disks, basically those elements can be found on those planets that have formed from those accretion disks. So these creatures, wherever they come from, apparently Zeta Reticuli. Bob Lazar was saying the third planet from the center, which is ZR3, has actually got naturally occurring 115. So they can just mine it and basically make these anti-gravity reactors.
So, Roger, with this anti-gravity drive, endothermic drive, it would have to have a system, because it's anti-gravity, it would have to have a system that would deal with the movement of the Earth. The Earth is moving like some 30 kilometers a second around the sun. So that craft, if it wasn't careful, could smash into the planet or be left out in space, since the Earth is moving so quick. If it overcomes the actual gravity of the sun and the Earth, I would think we'd have to have some kind of system that would deal with a countermeasure with that.
Yeah, well, the generator, apparently, according to Bob Lazar, can be turned on and off. If you take the apparently the reactor itself has a sort of like a cap to it, and if you take the cap off, it turns the actual it's like a cyclotron, so it turns it off. But when you put the cap on, it generates, it activates it, and then it generates the a gravitational wave. So I don't know how that interacts with the Earth's gravitational wave. I suppose it counteracts it, or it actually the generator actually, according to Bob Lazar, it warps time and space itself. So
he mentioned, sorry, Roger, he mentioned the effect of a bowling ball on a mattress, didn't he, is the way it propels.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, so basically, if you're dealing with this reactor, distorts the space and time just before the craft, so that the craft falls down this space-time continuum that it's warping in front of it. So basically, obviously you've got the Earth's gravitational force as well. And the anti-gravity reactor form, I just remember Bob saying that when he was at S4, he put his hand, Barry, the guy that he was working with, said, put your hand near this reactor. And it was repelling his hand, and he thought it was amazing because, you know, what would do that? You know, what would his hand's not made of metal. So basically this is like pushing, when you push two like poles of a magnet together, it's that same effect. Now, I'm sure that as kids we all did the same thing when we're experimenting with magnets. We put two like poles together and basically they were repelling each other. So that's the sort of effect that he got. So it's like counteracting the gravitational effects of Earth, by warping the time and the space before the craft, so that it can actually it's got three, apparently, these craft. Well, the craft that he was working on had three generators, so it had an amplifier and an emitter. So the emitter would force the gravitational wave through the There's the generator, then there's the gravitational emitter. The gravity amplifier. Then there's a gravity emitter, and so you can change the orientation of the actual the gravity amplifiers and the emitters, so that basically the craft can actually hover. So if you have two of the gravity amplifiers facing one direction, and the other gravity amplifier at 180 degrees, well, then you can have the craft hover and then move along a straight line.
Okay. What do you think about, according to that documentary, that he may have element 115 somewhere hidden away? The feds raided his office.
Yep. Yep. So we don't know, because when Jeremy did this documentary with Bob, he hasn't disclosed it, and he just fast forwarded it in his documentary. So we don't know what Bob has actually said.
Like, he doesn't want to even discuss.
No, I don't think that Jeremy wants to actually disclose this at the moment, unless something happens to Bob.
Do we actually think that he's got a smoking gun, or is it just something he doesn't want to discuss for some reason?
Well, I think George Knapp was saying that if we do find 115, if we do find it, it's absolute proof that a stable isotope of 115, either at Los Alamos or somewhere else that Bob knows where it might be located, it's absolute proof that his story is absolutely, legitimate. He seems to be quite cagey about the whole issue, and I would be too, because if I were in his situation, because it's obviously an extremely, dangerous as well as important piece of material.
Is this something that he could be producing himself? Because obviously he's involved in nuclear science.
Yeah. I doubt that he'd be producing that in his laboratory, United Nuclear.
Yep.
But I think that obviously he was saying that it was actually manufactured at Los Alamos at one stage. Okay. And I think at one stage he must have had some. I hate saying that, because what else could account for his behavior?
And also what else could account for being raided by the FBI on a regular basis?
Sorry, I missed that. Can you say that again?
Sorry, I was saying what else would account for being raided by the FBI on a regular basis?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically the FBI, the FDR and the NRC, I think he said that I had raided his laboratory twice. They said that they were looking for this document, which they could have quite easily emailed him about or just given him a phone call about some hazardous material that he had. But it just didn't explain. It was just overkill, the amount of people that were in his laboratory. And so they might be, I think they might be after documentation relating to 115, but I don't think that they think he's got it in his laboratory.
It'd be a stupid place to leave it though, wouldn't it?
Sorry?
It'd be a stupid place to leave it on his.
Absolutely. I think Bob's quite an intelligent guy.
He's not dumb enough to leave it at work.
He's a very, very smart guy. You can just tell by the way he talks and his demeanor and everything. So basically, he wouldn't do anything as stupid as that. And, maybe at one stage he did have some, like in the late 80s or the early 90s, but he was smart enough to get rid of it. And that's the question as to whether he actually had some in his laboratory at any one stage.
Roger, do you think with them having these craft for so long that maybe they would actually just be using some of them? Like, I think there were like not up to 9 craft he mentioned these doors.
Yeah. Yeah, there were 9. Apparently, 9 craft in S4. Yeah. So, what were
they using them for, trials and so forth? And
you mean back engineering them, or
like using them for special ops, and that obviously there'll be a huge advantage to having craft like that in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. I think the problem is that they haven't quite back engineered them yet. They Bob was saying that they the Russians were working with them at one stage, and then basically that they made a big discovery, and then they told the Russians to get lost because they wanted to keep it, you know, secret. So they have sort of like made some progress, but I don't think they've back engineered it properly, and I don't think they've actually quite worked out how it still works. Because if they had the 115, they could operate the machine. They could obviously they have done this before when they would test flying the machines at Papoose Lake in the late 80s when Bob got caught watching the actual test flights, because he knew that on the Wednesday they were being done when there was least traffic around the roads surrounding Papoose Lake.
Do you think some of the sort of technology and development, you know, I'm talking about things that come under the black budget that they're not going to announce publicly, in your opinion, the technology is a result of reverse engineering?
Yeah, look, I have a problem with that, because reverse engineering of these instruments, these bits and pieces they get from the UFO are quite difficult. I mean, obviously, as an analogy, if you had a smartphone and you dropped it off to cave people, you know, like Neolithic people, you know, they could probably turn it on or work out how to turn it on and everything and be amazed by how it works, but they could never back engineer anything like that. No. I think it's the same situation that we're in. We just are just so far behind.
The scale of evolution is distant.
Yeah, I don't know. See, there's been a lot of talk about reverse engineering of these vehicles, and not only just reverse engineering of any little one item could be impossible at this stage, and whether they're using that for black ops projects, I doubt it, because anything that's come out of Skunk Works or anything recently, or anything that we know of, like the stealth bomber or anything, hasn't really got any of the technology that this craft would have. I'm not sure what
material. I think that obviously Skunk Works, you're talking about Lockheed Martin.
Yeah.
I think that sort of vehicle, in my opinion, wouldn't be on display at Lockheed Martin. I think the environment that they would be developing that would be in so secure that, you know, there would be no access for media or even whistleblowers or anything. It would have been the same level of security that you would have had at Area 51 in the old days.
Yeah. As you say, we don't know what they've got at this point in time. So it's impossible to speculate as to whether they've actually, you know, reverse engineered something off these craft to actually employ it in a vehicle that they're currently working on or developing at Lockheed Martin.
Roger, but,
you see, that's their aim, you know.
Have you heard of Weatherman Charles Hall
story? Weatherman Charles Hall, no.
There was a man that reportedly had worked at a base right by that area, the same around S4. That he talked about tall white aliens, and he said that somehow we got technology exchange, but I can't really ask you any questions regarding that, since you're not familiar with them. But I was just wondering if there was any anything that kind of agreed with Bob's story. But
No, I've never heard of that guy, but there was the name of this guy's just left me at the moment. The guy that went round, you might be able to help me, Jim. The name of this, the guy that actually published The Day After Roswell.
No, but our friend Mr. Google will look it up while we're talking about it.
I've got a memory like a sieve these days.
day after Roswell. Just keep talking, Roger. I'll edit.
Yeah. So, it's very difficult to back engineer these things, and I'd be really surprised if they actually have anything that's
You're talking about Philip J. Corso, aren't you?
Philip J. Corso. Yeah. Sorry. I'm not sure whether either you or Mark know the story behind Phil Corso.
Give us a bit of a background.
Yeah. So basically he apparently was allegedly involved in the Roswell incident, where he was high up in the military at the time, but he apparently distributed some items of the craft, which were then developed. Apparently the electronic chip was developed off a component that was retrieved from the Roswell crash.
Mm-hmm.
Roswell crash. Not only that, Kevlar, night vision, and a few others.
So stuff that's got modern applications was sourced as a result of the.
That's right.
The debris of.
Quite tie in with the Lazar story, or whether these vehicles that they've got are different in terms of whether the one that. The sports model that so-called sports model that Bob was working with is a different craft to the one that crashed at Roswell, if there was a crash at Roswell.
Yeah.
Because structurally they're different. Bob was saying that there's no electronic parts on the one that he was working on.
It would be a fair hypothesis that different alien races would have different technology.
Yeah, true. But if it was the same race, even they might have a different. Like we've got Tesla cars these days, which are different to the normal cars, battery operated. They can drive themselves virtually, so we've got different technology here as well for the same sort of vehicle that we operate. Some vehicles operate off petrol, some off. Battery power, some off diesel. You know, it just depends upon what sort they need the craft for. So I guess I don't know, but yeah, not all the stories tie in well with each other. But
what do you think are the strong points of Lazar's story?
Strong points are, I think that. You know, the thing that I mentioned about the waveguide on these vehicles that he mentions, he also mentions, he said that back in the 80s that these craft worked off gravity waves. And in those days, they didn't know about gravity waves, basically. It's only recently, in 2015, that we actually have managed to see a gravity wave. They, as he said before in that documentary, they used to think in the 80s that the gravity was actually gravity was a particle, not a part particle, part wave, but it was operated off gravitrons, what they call gravitrons. But that's actually wrong. And so he was actually correct in the sense that he knew back in the 80s that gravity waves existed, although it could have been a 50-50, you know, like, punt at that one. So that, according to and also the structure of the actual vehicle, in terms of the gravity guide, the wave guide, and also the fact that he knew a lot of people, which you really can't account for. In terms of, he actually gave names during that interview, like a couple of people, like Mike Thigpen, who actually was the guy who was a security guy who actually did a security background check on him and his family before he actually started work at S4 at the EG&G building in Nevada. Yep. So basically, apparently Jeremy Corbell managed to track him down, and he said, basically I do remember Bob, and I do remember doing a background check on him before he started work at S4. And then Jeremy Corbell came up with this bombshell about basically he actually found a card with a bit of writing on it that was actually Mike Thigpen's writing and his signature that was given to one of his friends when he was doing the background check. So that is absolute proof that Bob Lazar did attend an interview in the EGNG building in Nevada, and that he actually was interviewed for a job at S4. He actually had also met I should put my brain in gear before I say things. he met Edward Teller as well. And Edward Teller apparently, he won't admit, I think I've seen a video of Edward Teller being interviewed about Bob Lazar, but he refuses to actually admit that he's met him. I could be wrong. I don't know.
Just to interrupt, do you think this pours a lot of cold water on the limited research that Stanton Friedman obviously did on the Bob Lazar story? Or his cynicism was garnered from the fact that he couldn't find anything on, but he obviously didn't look as hard as these guys did.
Yeah, I think Stan just looked at his credentials in terms of his lack of evidence for him working at MIT and Caltech. And basically, that's probably not enough. He sort of like just put two and two together and just said, okay, well, I can't find any records of him working at studying at Caltech or MIT, so therefore he's a fraud. And that's what I believe, because I absolutely believe Stan and a lot of things that Stan said. But unfortunately, yeah, Stan probably just drew the line there and says, look, he's a fraud because I can't find that.
And then the story went away for a number of years as well.
Yeah, it went away for a number of years. And I think that Stan put the kibosh on the whole thing. And unfortunately for Bob, and I have a lot of, I had a lot of respect for Stan. I've communicated with him before, and you know, over the Roswell incident and a few other things. And he was a very knowledgeable guy, and he used to, like, he'd go through everything with a fine tooth comb.
And he didn't appear to be prone to hyperbole or anything like that either.
No, that's right. But the first time I've been following Bob Lazar for close to 30 years, probably 20 odd years anyway, because I'm not sure when the story actually came to Australia from the CBS in the United States. I'm not quite sure, but I did see a documentary about it in the very early 90s about Bob, and then I went on YouTube and listened to his interview with George Knapp. It struck a chord with me because I thought, this guy sounds really intelligent and really legitimate, and the way he's composed when people ask him questions, and he's never flustered, and he can always put a sentence together very, very well, and also describes the science behind it extremely well. So that really impressed me about Bob.
Well, what's really interesting too was in Jeremy's documentary, there's the mention of the hand scanner that would the bones
and the hand, yep.
And that Jeremy was able to dig up this use of the scanner for the, was it the Stealth project they had used? He had some photos of the device.
Because it was unique to that particular security area, wasn't it? It wasn't seen anywhere else in, you know, any other sort of high security installations or anything like that, was it?
That's right. So basically, I did a little bit of research behind this. That Jeremy documentary states that he couldn't find it initially. He couldn't find anything about it's I think it's I forgot what it's called actually, but it's got a specific name.
It's just a hand bone scanner or something like that.
Yeah, I'll
look it up while we speak.
Yeah, I think it's an Identimat 2000. So basically, they were produced in the 1970s. So if you I went on to Reddit. There was an interesting discussion on Reddit about the hand scanner, and you always get debunkers trying to nitpick what Bob's saying.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of the Reddit posters was just saying that basically these hand scanners were around before the 1980s. They were actually developed in the 1970s, and basically even in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you can see one of them being used in that one segment of the movie, one split second of the movie.
You've got to wonder where they get the source material for that as well.
Yeah. And also, basically Jeremy said that he couldn't find it initially, and then he found a photo of it. And I think that it doesn't discredit Bob's argument that they were produced before the 1980s. They were around before Bob, came out with this story. I think that obviously they are legitimate devices that are used in high security areas like S4. And I'm sure that Bob would have used it, and he wouldn't have known anything about it until he started working at S4. So even though there's an article in a computer magazine, it's a Computer World, page 21, December 1971 edition of the magazine. They've got an actual advert about the hand scanner.
Oh, really?
So it goes way back till then. So just because Bob's used one in the 80s, he wouldn't have necessarily known about it, as I said before. I have no doubt that they would use this as a legitimate.
Well, now that I know they were sort of in the public eye by way of an advertisement in a magazine, I think it was him working there.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Excellent. You got another question for us, Mark?
Oh, if you had a chance to talk to Bob, what would you ask him?
Okay, that's a good question. I'd love to talk to Bob. I really would.
Have you tried to approach him at all, Roger?
No, I haven't. He's probably quite a difficult person to get. He doesn't, as I said, he doesn't like talking about his employment at S4. But yeah, I'd probably like to talk to him a little bit more about the craft and what they did with it, and how exactly did they?
You might be able to reach him through his company, United Nuclear. I had a science project, aerospace project, when I was living in America, and I actually ordered some supplies through his company.
Oh, wow.
It was an Element 115, wasn't it?
No, it's only okay. The stuff called aerogel. It's one of the lightest solids known to man.
So if I get a knock on my door.
Is it aerogel?
They'll be looking for 115.
Oh, excellent.
So you managed to contact him, Mark?
No, I just ordered stuff through his company, but I thought, oh, that might be an avenue that might, you're right. I'm sure it would be very hard to make contact with him, though.
I think so, yeah. Unless you actually had to fly out there and actually meet him, and he'd agreed to meeting you, I wouldn't like to contact him on the phone or email him. I'd have to personally just go there. I have to go to Michigan. I think that's where he lives, Michigan.
What do you, Roger, your opinion on his nondescript descriptions, for lack of a better term, of the spaceships, in terms, he said he was dealing with sort of a molded consoles, there was room for a 3-foot sort of being to sit there and control the ship, but there was no visible controls aside from a transparent wall or an LCD kind of style wall that would give positioning information and that sort of stuff. All part of the technology. I was hypothesizing that it might have something to do with the fact they communicate telepathically and perhaps don't need that instrumentation to pilot the ship. I don't know where you stand on that.
Yeah, I have heard this before by Phil Corso mentioned something about them being able to manipulate the craft through thought processes. I can't say that's impossible. As Bob was saying, there's no wiring, and that's just a very simple sort of craft. And I suppose in simplicity, you can find something doesn't have to be extremely complicated to be advanced. Unlike what we're doing, we're not using an anti-gravity propulsion system in anything that we produce. We're producing thrust, and that's pushing our vehicles forward because we're combusting fuel. These craft don't work in any way like that. So, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be complicated. This is the whole thing behind advanced technology. It can be quite simple, but if you, like Bob was saying, if you work out how to propel yourself through space in a unique way that defies gravity in a way. Once you crack that nut, you've actually and that's the hardest thing to do, is to actually work out how to actually curve space and time.
Yeah.
Once you've done that, you don't need to have complicated instruments and wires. Well,
it's really about,
you know, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, if you can bend, you know, if you can create your own wormhole or bend the space-time continuum as a form of propulsion.
Yeah. And in fact,
you don't need the instrumentation necessarily, do you?
No, not necessarily. And also, in fact, basically, if something's simple, it means that the less, I know the Tesla cars have only got, or is it 35 moving parts or something like that?
Yeah.
The less moving parts you have, the less complicated a craft is, the less likely it is to actually crash or have a problem.
If you've found the panacea, like in this case of the 115 or the same.
It really makes sense because, I mean, we've had so many we've had two space shuttles that have gone up and crashed. Yeah. So there's the more complicated the machinery, the more likely something will go wrong. So the least complicated the machinery, the less likely, I guess, it is to have a problem, an issue with something going wrong, because there just aren't that many things there to go wrong.
That's a nice application of Occam's razor, actually, there, Roger. The simplest explanation.
Exactly.
The correct one.
Exactly. So, you know, like it makes sense to me, but and I don't know how they do it. I don't know how you can produce something like that that's just so simple. As you're saying, it looks like it's cast from one mold, and basically there's no edges to it. It's a curved, you know, just it looks, it's seamless. Apparently the portholes are actually, they sense the actual surroundings. So basically they're a bit, what Bob Lazar was saying, they're a bit like that. That's their computer that senses the environment, senses the, where the positioning of the craft, et cetera. And it, maybe they have a connection that they, Phil Corso was saying that in the Roswell incident, that the aliens had a little headpiece that they put on that connected their thought processes to the actual craft. I don't know whether that's true or not. And a lot of people saying that the Roswell incident was rubbish and it didn't actually happen. And, you know, that you can't get I-beams from – see, this is the thing. You know, you look at the Roswell incident, the two main witnesses – here goes my memory again
obviously the rancher, wasn't it? The rancher, or
yeah, the rancher, and also the lieutenant.
Mac Brazel,
So Mac Brazel, the way he described the debris, and also the other two guys. What was that other guy's name? The guy that was in the Air Force. So basically, the way that the pieces of material that were described, don't really fit into the mold that Bob Lazar's been talking about. So
what was Major Jesse Marcel?
Jesse Marcel, yeah. So Jesse Marcel described the debris. Although Jesse Marcel Jr., they're both deceased now, unfortunately. Even Jesse Marcel Jr., but when he was 11, he saw the material, and he was saying that he saw I-beams that had pinkish purple writing on them. He saw tinfoil, but then he said the tinfoil didn't react as if it was memory metal. So this is in opposition to what other witnesses were saying. But I don't see how any of this material could be part of an actual spacecraft because of what Bob Lazar's been. But then again, you never know. I mean, this is 1947.
Yep.
Their craft.
Retro technology, isn't it?
Yeah. So the craft that were picked up in those, I mean, the craft that actually, allegedly crashed in 1947 could have been a different spacecraft from a different civilization that Bob was looking at.
Yep.
That could have been a different spacecraft that from the same civilization, but an earlier model. I don't know. But
and also, it's just evolution. We're not driving around in cars. We were driving around in 1947, were we?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Although we do have some 1947 vehicles on the road,
sure.
Redone up.
I think part of the Roswell What interests me a little bit in the sense is the shiny metallic debris that was reported, et cetera, which they easily, you know, morphed into being part of a weather balloon, et cetera. It's just at that time in history, 1947, there was a bit of a UFO hysteria going on. Lots of movies being made about, you know, invaders from Mars and all these sort of everyone's wearing shiny metallic suits. I mean, the invaders are. The UFOs are how we perceive them, you know, artist impressions. One person said they saw a shiny metallic upside down saucer, and the term flying saucer got coined. I just think it could be a victim of pop culture at the time. And again, we'll probably never know anyway, so it's, it would just be speculating. But I think that may have something to do with it.
I really can't, like, Stan still stood by Roswell to the day he died, but I don't know whether the Roswell incident was actually real. Unfortunately, I stood by it for many, many years, and I even in 1988 I wrote a letter to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and about it. This is when the first MJ-12 papers came out and mentioned Roswell.
Yeah.
So I photocopied the pages and I sent them the pages, and they sent back a very quick response denying the whole thing to me.
Yeah.
That was 1988, a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they were very quick with their response, and they were still like, wondered where the hell do these documents come from. So I don't know. I mean, I saw, like, it rung a bell with me. Like, I saw, like, it made sense at the time. I don't know. But when I look at it conjectively, I sort of like think, okay, well, they're talking about I-beams. Why would you have an I-beam in a spacecraft? I mean, I don't understand. Why would you have tin foil in it, like any sort of, even if it was memory metal? If it was a thin sheet of memory metal, how would it come off a spacecraft that, like Bob Lazar was talking about? But then again, as I said before, you know, it all boils down to the different types of craft that they have and the different technology, different stage of the technology. If it crashed, well, then, you know, like, it could have been. But going back to the ones that Bob was looking at, he says that they were found from archaeological digs, which is really weird, because that's one thing I'd like to ask Bob. Does he know anything about the craft that was allegedly retrieved at Roswell? So I'd like to ask.
Yeah, that's never come up with him, has it?
No, he and very cleverly so, he never ever talks about it. I've never heard him talk about or state that one of those 9 craft were actually from Roswell.
That was my next question. Where did we actually get these craft from?
Well, he was saying that they were from archaeological digs, at least the one that he was working on was. Mm-hmm. And he said that.
Did he say where they were, where these digs were?
No, he doesn't state where they were. And he also sort of like finds it quite odd that he got told that they were from an archaeological dig, because he was saying that, you know, like, well, where are these archaeologists? And, you know, when they discovered it, why wasn't it worldwide news that they came across this spacecraft that was either buried or whatever? Why wasn't this world news when it was discovered? So he's saying that they could be 10,000 years old. You know, he's saying that they're ancient. So that even they could be, you know, anywhere between, you know, 1,000, 10,000, 20,000 years old.
Didn't Bob mention something about alien cadavers that he had seen? I wonder about that.
Yeah, he was shown some briefing documents about a cadaver that of an extraterrestrial biological entity. So basically, he just drew what he remembered, and it looked like your typical grey. And he describes it very briefly, but then again, you know, where's that alien from? If this is an archaeological, well, that alien would be well and truly decayed by the time they bloody well found it. You know, like, I mean,
yes, good point.
So basically, where that cadaver came from, I don't know. That doesn't quite make sense. That, you know, that maybe this is just a cadaver that they've retrieved from a recently crashed vehicle. I don't know, and it could be Roswell. I don't know. But he said that he was shown photographs in the briefing documents that were given to him prior to him being employed at S4. So So they gave him all this information to say, look, this is what you're going to be, this is what you're going to be dealing with, you know?
Okay, excellent. And I think it lends weight, if that's talking about this archaeological dig, that lends weight to an ancient alien sort of theory that's been bandied around.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's very true. And
obviously these civilizations, alien civilizations, are going to be at different stages of development in terms of industry, and that's much like humans have been. So one of them is going to have a flashier, more advanced ship than the other, aren't they?
That's right.
Assuming they're not all from the same place, which we shouldn't do, because that's just crazy.
Well, true. Bob says that one other thing that Bob says, which gives a bit of credence to what he's saying as well, is that he's saying that the spacecraft that he was working on came from Zeta Reticuli. So that's a star system. It's a double star system. But that rang a bell with me, because Betty and Barney Hill were, and I don't know whether you must have heard of Betty.
I've heard the story, yeah.
So basically, apparently, Betty Hill was shown a hologram of a star system on board the craft when she was on board the craft. And basically, she said, "Where are you from?" to the leader. And he said, he showed her this map, this hologram map. And he said, "Where do you think you are on this map?" And she says, "I have no idea." And he goes, "Well, this is our star system." And she replicated that on paper. And basically, it's a binary star system that's from Zeta Reticuli. So it really makes sense that, you know, this craft that he was working for Zeta Reticuli, because they apparently were here in 61, you know, when they abducted Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah.
So, it was interesting that he actually said that he was told by Barry or Dennis, who is his supervisor, that particular craft was from Zeta Reticuli.
Do you think it's a recent phenomenon? I mean, post sort of 1940s, when I talked about this sort of UFO hysteria and so forth. Do you think my theory is that a lot of that was tied in with the Cold War and the threat of nuclear war and that sort of thing? But it makes sense that an advanced race has been visiting us probably since the beginning of time, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I don't think that it's a post-war. It's turned out to be a post-war thing, because Kenneth Arnold actually, he started the ball rolling when he saw these objects that he saw over Mount Rainier in Washington in 1947.
Yeah,
3 months before the Roswell crash or something like that. He started
summer 1947 was known for activity, wasn't it? There was a lot of UFO sightings.
It was the biggest flap.
Yeah,
I think that's when they were found over the Capitol Hill. Even before then, you look at the Foo Fighters during the war. You can go back further, and there's mentions of crashes of spacecraft in Italy when Mussolini was in charge. There's and triangles, you know, like those UFO triangles that are around. They go back to pre-war times, and I think that people were just. They just didn't know what the hell was going on, and there were reports of a UFO crash in the 1890s, you know, in the States.
Yeah.
The retrieval of the actual crashed vehicle and the occupant.
How much weight do you give to ancient alien theorists, you know, like old mate Giorgio, who's always on TV, making tenuous links between, you know, cave paintings and visitations by unearthly beings?
I'm no expert. But all I can say is that from what I feel, basically I think there's too much of an emphasis on the ancient alien theory.
Yeah.
I think that there's some credence to the actual fact that there could have been these vehicles could have been around in ancient times. And sometimes you can dismiss a lot of the artifacts that they come out and say that basically, this looks like a UFO, this looks like an alien. sometimes you can't. The Hopi Indians were, it's an interesting one where the Hopi Indians in Nevada, I think they were in the state of Nevada, drew petroglyphs on rocks. This is quite interesting, where they actually apparently they witnessed a crash landing of a UFO thousands of years ago, mm-hmm. and they interacted with the actual aliens, I think, whether they were viewing them from a distance and looking at what they were doing, but they saw them repair the craft and then take off again. Mm-hmm. But they tried to depict this in petroglyphs on the rock, the whole incident. And basically they have things like sine waves and all this, you know, like how would they know what a sine wave is? And, you know, just really weird stuff that they've drawn, and like pictures of the petroglyphs of the pictures of the actual, I think, the craft and the aliens. And it was quite interesting that they could, you know, replicate that as a petroglyph on rock, based on an incident. And I think, yeah, that.
So, what do you think, Roger, in coming to modern times, about the revelations regarding the ATEP program and the gimbal and the Tic Tac incident, where the US Navy had seen these anomalies that had outskirted their pilots and had been picked up on multiple radar platforms?
Yeah. What can I say? Basically, it is what it is. Basically, the nobody's come up to dispute it. Basically, the Pentagon's released it. They're saying that they haven't released it, but I mean, it was leaked from the Pentagon, and basically these videos of the actual craft are I guess real. There's three of them. There's the gimbal, the Go Fast, and the Tic Tac, and you know, like Jeremy Corbell's done a lot of work on it, and basically also Tom DeLong, and you know, obviously they're working with Harry Reid, and they're working with that other guy who I've forgotten his name with. So basically, these are people that work in intelligence, and they're supporting the theory that these craft are real, and basically they don't know what the hell they are, and.
To be a big concern to military officials, who the military is supposed to defend the airspaces of the country, and yet the craft are going with impunity around airliners, and various people have seen them.
I think the government's really very well aware of it, and the thing is that I think that they realise that they can't do anything about it, so they try to dismiss it. So basically, they're saying, okay, well, I think there's some sort of understanding by the United States government, at least the United States government, that there's no danger involved, no impending danger, because of the fact, even though they are flying the in airspace with impunity, and it's contravening their policies of, you know, like invasion of airspace, but basically they can't do anything about it. And so basically, rather than, you know, like highlight the fact that they need to do something about it because this is a security breach by aircraft that are unknown aircraft that could be originating from, you know, China or Russia or somewhere else, they'd rather just ignore it and you know, put a blanket over the whole thing so that they don't have to address it. And I think that, as I said before, there's an understanding that nothing will come of this. The actual craft will not attack any of our craft, you know, any of the vehicles that we fly. Although there was an incident in that one of the unidentified programs where they went to DeLong and this other guy, oh, I forgot his name, Mellon.
Swans.
Chris Mellon. I think that basically they went to Italy and spoke to some of the people in government there, and they were saying that there was a helicopter that was actually brought down by a beam that was shot from a UFO, and they have pictures of it. So I don't know. That was one incident that I know of. But they're very intelligent craft, because what happened, see, when I don't know whether you know about the incident with the HMS Australia and a couple of other aircraft carriers during the Vietnam War, where during in a demilitarized area, there was some there was a warship that actually shot at some UFOs, but they actually deflected the actual ammunition back at the vehicle that where it originated from. So it's quite intelligent how they know that if they just send back what we give them in terms of ammunition, it's not as if they're actually they're not actually
they're
firing,
not engaging us, and we're just bombarding.
Just quite like it's incredibly intelligent. It's you know, like in other words, they're just deflecting what
they, and those vehicles could be autonomous as well, couldn't they? I mean, some surveyor drone or probe droid to put a space Star Wars turn on things.
Well, I don't know what Trump's talking about, this Space Force thing, and whether that's got anything to do with this,
I think he wants to build a wall on the moon.
A wall on the moon.
To keep out illegal space immigrants. The stellar immigration.
Fix the Mexican wall before he does that.
That's right. All right, we're almost at end of our time for another session, Roger, but thanks for coming on the show once again, as insightful as ever. I was just going to ask you before you go about the storming of Area 51. Will you be there, or would you rather not get shot?
I think that basically I'd love to be there, but I think that storming Area 51 is not because if they want to storm Area 51 to find UFOs, they're not there.
No.
They're probably not
even moved a long time ago, haven't they?
They're probably not even at S4 anymore. So they're probably at a different location. So I would like to know where they're located, and then I would join the storm.
Sure. No. So you're prepared to...
Oh, yeah, I'd go out there, definitely. Yeah. If there was a whole horde of people, I'd be doing it. But I'd have to know exactly where they're located.
I'd probably need a bit of Dutch courage myself before I did it, but however...
I've been out to Nevada and I drove past Area 51. Well, not past it, but I mean, it was quite a long way from it. But I've driven on the extraterrestrial highway.
Yep.
And I stopped off at the little alien.
Yeah, that's cool.
And got my little, little alien driver's license. So I know the area very well. I don't know how they're going to storm it, because it's actually midsummer there. Oh. So the temperatures get up to about 55 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, there's no toilets over there. I actually flew my drone on that road there up like close to 1,000 feet. Good thing they didn't nab me.
Oh, you had a drone, right?
Yeah, okay. I flew up my Phantom drone in restricted airspace. And
wow.
I would have lost it if I went too high because it was really windy.
Yeah, but I think they've got to take their water with them because that's going to be difficult midsummer. Storming that, I've been there at 53 degrees. I went on a dune and it was just horrendous. Yeah. It was really quite easy.
It's hotter than Australia.
Yeah. You don't need someone to shoot you. You'll just die of dehydration.
All right, excellent. Thanks for coming on the show, Roger.
No worries, Jim. Thanks. It's a pleasure.
See you later, mate. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Hey, Mark. Bye. See you.